Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an x-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Sharon.
My name is Ed.
And I'm Sean.
And today we are looking at Father and Sons, Season 4, Episode 7.
Mm-hmm. What an episode.
Mm-hmm.
Cinematic. I would say it's probably one of the best episodes of television ever. And I'm not saying that as an ER fan. I think it is stunning.
I think it's really well acted. It's so well directed. And actually, my first note is that opening vista shot and the music. Oh, yes. You're so right. It's just like I've stepped out of County General and I've stepped into Thelma and Louise or something, you know, to take in the full scale. Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic.
And kind of taking on that kind of the connotation, something like Thelma and Louise, you know, it's about a friendship, you know, this is central, the central friendship is in this of kind of Mark and Doug. And this is actually the first episode that was in the series to be filmed completely away from the ER unit. Every other one we would have some kind of link back, but this one is completely out. And it feels special, doesn't it? It feels different, which is why I think also it's a bit refreshing. So as you say, we kind of open on this really beautiful vista of these kind of hills, and we see this really long road, and there's a little car traveling on it, and I mean the metaphors are just there, you know,
right?
We're just lost in the wilderness. And ironically, so the two, obviously this is almost exclusively a Doug and Mark episode, and like, so we've come to such a switch in their characters by season four. By this stage, season four, Doug is so much more grounded. He has his metaphorical together, and you know, he's so different from what he was in season one. And completely on the flip side, Mark is so lost.
Yes.
And he's just like to the point where, even though on paper Mark and Doug are the best of friends, you do catch yourself in the beginning going, Mark, why are you here?
Yeah. Or also, Doug, why do you not just open his door, throw him out? It was all a favour.
Leave him in the desert for the vultures to pick at his bones.
Leave him in the desert for him to just to get his crap together, you know, to have some visions and realise he's wrong. And then he would turn back up a few episodes from now, you know, all dusty and gross, but just changed.
Having had some experience with, I'm just thinking of The Simpsons now, the Johnny Cash coyote, who would have, you know,
given him some peyote.
He just needs that, because I mean, we get into the car, which is very small car, you know,
it's the worst car ever.
And Doug says, you know, this was all they had. I had asked for a mid-range size car. They did not have that. And Greeny's like the kid in the back. Well, how long have we got left? Well, what about now? Oh, it's hot. Oh, the air conditioning isn't working. And this is what I mean. I don't understand how Doug doesn't just throw him out.
Character growth. Doug is ready to be a father because he doesn't roundhouse kick the child in the face asking all the questions, which I believe is frowned upon when a parent does that to a child. So that's good. But Doug said something. So obviously we're all, you know, Northwest Europe, I'm Ireland, you're the UK. So when Doug Turana says, it's November, who would ask for a car with air con? I'm like, what are you talking about? It's November.
I had to wear a scarf this week. Jesus Christ.
Oh, I know.
Oh my goodness.
It's getting down, starting to get down, isn't it? Into the coldness. So we have Green kind of moaning. We've got Doug just trying to drive and get where he needs to be. They stop off at a gas station, as the Americans call it, and Green says, you know, what was your dad doing out here? Because we are just in the middle of these kinds of this wilderness, all these hills with no life and no anything really around. So it's a fair question.
Yeah, it's that kind of I don't know if it's this exact road, but you know, when you think of the stereotypical image of the American road trip, the Route 66, you know, the miles and miles and miles of just the black road and nothing on either side. But it looks like he's just here, and you know, it's like, was he running from something? Was he running to something? You can't imagine that he was staying here. It's not the kind of place that would be like, oh well, we'll set up shop for here forever.
It feels transient, doesn't it? And actually it all looks so similar. It at points it feels a bit like you're playing Mario Kart, and I was kind of waiting for things to kind of, you know, jump up, just because it was just the same, you know, it was just
throws
like,
a banana behind it and
yeah, just
Yoshi
like
flip off. Yeah,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. So well, the next scene we're in the police station, and he's getting his kind of dad's effects, and we learn that the dad was with a woman, a companion, Sherry Fox, as well as he ploughed into a pickup truck, which yeah. a father of six, Pedro Lopez, was driving. And he was, you know, quite over the limit. He was drunk. And,
yeah.
Oh, it's just horrible to hear this ending, isn't it?
There's a quote from a Stephen King novella, The Body, the one that was made into Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And it describes a character who is killed in a car crash, but there's other people killed as well. And they said there is this image of people who die in car crashes, that if you die alone, you become this sort of tragic victim, you know, oh, we feel so bad for you. If you take somebody with you, you're a wet end.
Yeah.
And you lose any and all sympathy straight away for Doug Sr. in this scene.
Yeah.
Because you find out that he was driving, he was four times over the limit, and two other people died as well.
I know.
Yeah, and one of them was a father of six. You know, yes. this is not a victimless, not that there would be if you killed anybody, but you know, this is like they really lay it on the, you know, this was a father of six. The next scene, we're kind of at the act, they're actually visiting the crash site. You know, somebody's actually put flowers out. We get to see Pedro's face. And Doug, this is where Doug's anger really comes out. You know, he says he can't even kill himself, right? And he also says at one point, I wish I could have killed him, could have saved a lot of time.
Such a strong statement to make. It's a bit of a shock. I mean, he obviously had a difficult relationship, and, you know, he's feeling guilty about not having intervened in some other way, clearly. Yeah. And it would have saved the father of six and Sherry Fox, who's this mystery character who we find out later also has, well, obviously she has a family, but...
Yeah, find out more about them, if you...
Yes,
yeah. She wasn't just... Yeah, she was... It really starts putting a human face on this tragedy. And I think what's brilliant about this, and we can say all the way through, is just the exploration of grief. You know, we really see how difficult it is and how complicated it is and how even when you don't, you know, necessarily get on with the person who passed, actually, when it's somebody like your dad, there are still so many emotions. It's so complex. And not more so than when we get to the actual motel. They get to the motel and they're looking through the belongings, and the motel owner is basically saying, oh, you know, they were a nice couple. So we're finding out a bit more about how they're living, and they seem to be living in this motel. And she says to him, you know, oh, you're the doctor. Your dad talked about you. He was so proud of you, which I think is a real shock for Doug, who I think doesn't think he even registers on the radar of his dad, does he?
There's all those pictures of the family, and
he's
got that picture of Doug, and I just did make a note that I love when they have pictures of actors, you know, as kids, as their characters, and they have to get them to bring it. I just always imagine, like, can you bring in a picture of you, a baby, that we can splice together with this person who's never your mother? Do you know what I mean? Those sort of weird, but anyway, clearly, like, there's a picture of Doug and his mum, this woman he was separated, you know, divorced from decades ago.
I thought that was fascinating. It wasn't just Doug, was it? And actually, a little bit of trivia on that high school picture. It was a real picture of George Clooney in his high school basketball, when he played high school basketball. And his high school was actually in Kentucky, which is what the reference is also to. So
that's cool.
I quite like when they do little bits like that. But I think that's a real shock for him, isn't it? You know, these are the things he was traveling with, not a lot, but the things he was traveling with were a lot of pictures of Doug and a lot of pictures of kind of Doug and the mom. And I wonder a little bit about how Sherry Fox felt about that. And B, it's like, it's just one of those things, isn't it? You know, somebody's gone and you're left with the kind of debris of their lives, and you're trying to make sense of it. And it's the mixed messages. So you can see Doug really struggling to kind of go, who is this man who couldn't, seemed like he couldn't give a crap in real life about me, but is carrying all this stuff around of me and talking about me and, you know.
Yeah.
I think the depiction of Doug's dad in this episode, obviously he's not on screen. He is the screen. You know, we are living the episodes, you know, in this world of him. And I think it is a fantastic micro depiction of a very three-dimensional person, much better, ironically, than when he actually was in the show, because then you are grounded in the actor's performance. You kind of have to follow their lead. But here you get all of the things that you were saying there about his past. You're getting drip fed the discoveries of not only his present but his end, and the way that he died doesn't match up with what we're discovering of how he was living his final days.
Absolutely.
So it's like, you know, what's the first thing that jumps into your mind when someone's four times over the limit, caused to other people? You know, you might think, oh, alcoholic, daredevil, doesn't give a whatever, and, you know, was clearly a bad person. And then you come back to this where he's living and you're like, now, certainly he did a horrifically bad thing, but what we're seeing doesn't then match up to that description of the bad person, daredevil, doesn't give a crap.
Absolutely.
Exactly. He's a three-dimensional person who made some very bad mistakes, but still had love in his heart. Do you know what I mean? He was capable of it. So he's not an evil demonic character going, I know, I'm going to get really ripped to, you know, rip-roar drunk and then plow into a father of six. There's also the mention, I don't know if I might be getting it mixed up, but Doug mentions about his dad's driving skills, that he'd often, like, drive with his knees, and drive with his eyes closed, things like that, to be a bit of a daredevil and just push the, you know, push limits a little bit. It's just kind of, having a brother who wants asked me to hold the wheel while I tied his shoelaces, that's terrifying. Social services, hello. No, it was a one-off. I'm not slagging my brother off. It's a thing. It's a quiet country road. There were no cars, but... and Lazarus were drunk, but it's this strange image of Doug's dad as this fully rounded but fully flawed character.
Yeah, and we get this really beautiful shot next of kind of the motel sign, and it pans down, and Doug's just sitting in the dark. And Mark kind of comes up and gives him a beer and they have a little chat. And I just thought there was just something about that moment where he's just completely alone in his thoughts that. He's not saying a lot, but he's saying a lot. You know, they're really showing he's just so thoughtful. And it leaves us to wonder all the different things he must be pondering, because I think we're probably a little bit pondering them too. Like, oh, he carried pictures and, he did this and had that. And also with the woman, because when you kind of first hear he was with a woman, you're not sure if he could have just, like, could have been somebody he picked up that night or could have been. But it's they were living together in this motel, you know, and you start really piecing together this the end of days of this man, really. And then my favourite bit, because the motel owner comes up and talks about how the fact that he left his car. Oh my God, this car is so, so beautiful. So it's a Cadillac 1959 series, 62 convertible. Oh my God, do I have a thing about these kinds of cars. I have this real dream of owning one.
I want to do the American road trip in a Cadillac. Now, I don't know if they are horrifically bad cars and will break down in a few miles, but if they do, it would be worth it for
I don't think they'll be economical.
Well, there is that. If I could get an economical version of this car, But I literally have written down here, George Clooney just nails that scene where he sits in the car because the amount of repressed emotion that is just bubbling under the surface when he's left alone to sit in that car, because it's not just a car, it's the entire childhood with his dad. And the pictures were strong, and the stories of he always used to talk about you was strong, but his dad kept this car and this was their thing.
Yeah.
And also I think, you know, with a car, personal effects thoughts are left in it, and yeah. and smells are left in it, and memories, you know. He's never been in that hotel room with his dad, but he's been in this car with his dad. So it's just, I think this is the thing that really makes, probably feels the closest possibly to kind of connecting back. And then they do this really cool shot where they kind of pan down and shot from the car, and then they fade into him actually driving with Green. And this is where we learn a bit more about why this car is so important. So he said in the previous scene that, you know, his dad has kept it all this time. He had it since the 70s. We can imagine him kind of coming home and working on it and all that. And then Doug says, you know, he taught me to drive on this car. So this is how important this car is. And he talks about how his dad would come home every so often and just whisk him off and take him away and then let him drive. And and it's one of those where you know it's really a painful memory, because you can see a lot of the recklessness of his dad and how his dad fathered him. But on the other hand, you know, there's that tenderness of, this is how he taught me to drive here, which is such a rite of passage and such a thing that you pass down. And I just thought that was, really beautiful, that just the way they evoked all of that.
Yeah.
I love the counter position of, so Doug, a few scenes ago, having a real go at his dad for being a real crappy father and asking him to take the wheel and all that kind of stuff. But then, as soon as he gets in the car, you write that sentimental, emotional flood of, it's actually quite romantic. It's the same, you know, it's the same person. It's the same situation that all of a sudden he's sat in that car, and you're right, it's so evocative. He's right there, and he's that kid who actually hero worshipped his dad a bit, but was also scared of him. We get bits of nostalgia from Doug through the episode, where we see, again, we're drawing a fully rounded character in memoriam, who was a mess, but he was fun. And do you know what I mean? I love how they've made this complicated character out of nothing, really.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, because we've gone from Doug a few scenes ago saying, I wish I'd killed him, to him saying, exactly. Now he says, oh, he had his moments, you know? Yeah. So he's starting to remember that. And I think that, again, is very grief, isn't it? You know, you have anger, and then sometimes you're laughing and sometimes you're crying, and, you know, it's all that stuff. And then run out of fuel. The gauge isn't correct.
I had to laugh at this one, because this is, it's almost like, you know, Ross Senior, of course the car is broken and of course the gas tank is running. And of course the spare thing is empty as well. Yeah. And it was just like, this is like almost like the episode is reminding us, like, yeah, but remember, he was a bit of a screw up. Because I know we're getting a much deeper, you know, great image of the guy, but he was also a screw up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely that. And they end up having to stay the night because they can't do anything. So they stay the night. And it's this really brilliant scene of this kind of really old rusty pickup truck kind of, you know, drives in, and we see the boots and the guy kind of coming up, and then you see Doug popping up, and then a bit later Mark popping up, and it's a bit comedic and quite cute, the idea of them being there, and Doug assumes straight away that this guy is Spanish, so he speaks to him. he only speaks Spanish possibly, so he speaks to him in Spanish, and the guy answers in English, which I loved.
It's a great scene, but there's so many aspects of this episode, the film, because it feels like a film, but it's so achingly beautiful and American. Do you know what I mean? There's so many aspects of pure Americana, the car, you know, the deserts, the church where they go for a little bit later, the pawn shop, you know what I mean? That's why it feels like a film in itself, because it feels like a photo essay for the law of Southern California in a way.
Yeah, it feels very like a Tarantino film or something. Yes. You know, these two guys on the road, and all this stuff just happens to, you know, keeps happening and end up in some kind of, like, I wouldn't have probably batted an eyelid if that guy had come out with a gun and tried to hold them up and take the car, or, you know, because it felt very like that. And as you say, you know, they end up at Pedro Lopez's kind of compound and ask a little boy where the family is. He says, oh, you know, they're all at the funeral today, so they go to that church, and that church, as you say, is so small, and it's just very stereotypical what you'd expect a church in the desert to look like, I guess. And you go inside, and obviously that, you know, there are people mourning, and that's where you see the little kids and the wife. And I think that's where Doug really just, he gets angry again, doesn't he? Because he's seeing what the effect of, he's seeing the kids who are going to grow up without a dad. He's seeing the wife who's growing up now without her, you know, living now without a husband, has become a single parent. And
that little
really,
lad waving at him, and just
And his face is just so, again, brilliant. And they also give it time to breathe. They really allow time to actually film and show that without any speaking, or just showing him going through all of that, which I thought was just beautiful, really.
Yeah.
What I thought particularly about that church, the physical church, you're so right, it's straight out of a film. I don't know, have either of you seen that film Tombstone?
Yes.
Probably.
Yeah, so it's and it was just like, it was like they just went, okay, listen, when Val Kilmer's finished filming here, we just leave him out of the scene, we'll bring in the next Batman, and he's going to film the scene. And it's both very stereotypical, but also it grounded me straight away in that it was a kind of a small community. Like, it's physically tiny, so when Doug and Mark step in, you know, you'd be forgiven. It's that kind of record skip moment when you walk into the bar and everything's like, who are these guys? There's no, you know, there's no kind of shuffle in and, you know, kind of pay our respects and shuffle out again, you know. And it's just shot so beautifully. The kid obviously ripping at our heartstrings.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's giving an NPC a full life, a full history, and he's not just some statistic. He was killed by Doug's dad accidentally, but Doug's dad ended this guy's life and ripped apart this family.
Sure.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, and I think it's different, isn't it? Because although it was an accident, you know, he was drunk, so it's not a complete accident. You know, there were factors that have made things worse. And then we see Doug, you know, really kind of freaking out. And Mark says to him, you know, it's not your fault, but you can see Doug is really taking it on that it is. And the father kind of walks over and starts talking to them. And Doug kind of confesses and says, you know, my dad was the one who killed him. And this priest says, you know, you must have really loved him to come out here. To try and give him some absolution, possibly.
I have two words. I have good priest written down here.
I can't remember what he said. He just said like a couple of words, and he was just like, it's not your fault. Do you know what I mean? You're not responsible. And it was just those simple words that, you know, he's leading this really upsetting, traumatic funeral, but he still has time for the guy who's the son of the, you know, the guy who killed this dad.
And invites him to the, you know, invites him to the interment, you know, are you coming? And as if to say, it's not weird that you're here, like, it's okay, you belong as well. Which, you know, hopefully goes, well, we don't know, but, you know. So I just thought, again, you know, really beautiful rounded out scene with just that little moment of kind of check-in. And then we end up in the rowdy pawn shop, which is, as Doug has kind of joked a few scenes before, that, you know, this is his inheritance, because basically what he's left behind are these receipts for things that he's pawned. So he's gone to find out what his dad has pawned, and it turns out it's his Rolex watch, a 3-carat diamond. Wow.
See the size of that rock?
I know.
I thought it was funny. He says that, you know, every night what dad would do after he brushes his teeth is he would do the watch. And I was like, that's actually not that strange, because one of the best things to bring up a shine on silver is toothpaste.
Oh, is it?
It's actually really, like, so say if you've got, so I have a silver clatter ring on my on my middle finger. I was not giving the guys the middle finger there as I was showing them. But this dulls and everything. Yeah. Just leave it sitting in a little bit of toothpaste, and then it'll wipe away a lot of that dull. So there's a handy trick now from me to you.
See. Thank you. And see, we're not just about, you know, podcasting on ER. We will also give you life hacks.
Whenever and wherever we can.
So they're in this pawn shop. And again, we're learning more. So she's got, you know, and we learn that she didn't want to give the ring. The dad kind of convinced her, which I think Doug is very much, and it's very in the character we know of Doug's dad. but they wouldn't give up their wedding rings. So they were like, they really were married, and obviously their wedding rings meant something to both of them, which is another little, a little thing. This is where Green loses his mind, because he sees a Cindy necklace with a little tiny shard of a diamond, and wants to buy it for Cynthia. And Doug quite rightly says, you buy that, you know, you're walking home, you're not part of this anymore, which I'm with. Like, what is he thinking? He's just manic. No, I just don't think, I just don't understand why he thinks that. He doesn't know this woman that well, and he's going to buy her a gold necklace with a diamond in it. Like, what are you? And she's a needy woman. She's not like a, we know she's very emotionally needy, and it just seems like the worst thing to be doing.
Like, it's, she's, in a way, she is everything you would want a partner. She's so open, she's so honest, she will tell you exactly how she's feeling, you know, so perfect. But also, you can't just string Cynthia along. That was evident from the first moment we met her. You know, she is not, like, there is a statement at some point where Doug, or Mark says, oh, we're having some fun. No, Mark. No, Mark, no, you're not.
You don't have a fun with somebody like that. You know, she's she will read something into everything. Yes. Although, if you give anybody a diamond necklace, that's fair as well. You know, read what you need to. But she already, like, is reading millions of things in, and she's naive. And but what is absolutely beautiful is we kind of cut to the motel, and Doug is holding the 3-carat diamond, and he's on the phone to Carol. He's got her machine. He's saying he misses her. He wishes she was there, but he's holding the diamond. And I'm like,
oh. I missed that. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's ready. He's ready. You know, Green walks in towards the end. Mark, you know, Doug tries to finish the conversation quite quickly, puts the phone down. Mark is very inquisitive. You know, who is it? I started naming every single person that's ever walked through the ER, which I thought was hilarious.
Kerry.
Yeah. Jeannie? It's Junie.
That Abby who left, who went to India.
Yeah.
Who?
Oh, who is it? Is it Morgan Stern?
Morgan Stern.
I mean, you're Tash.
You know, the character that walked in for 2 seconds in the first episode and walked out again? Like, he's really, like, asking him. Doug says to him, you know what? It's Carol. And Mark, he's just like, what? I never thought she'd take you back, you know? Wow.
Initially, I was getting really thick with Mark here, because it's really presented like, Mark, you're being horrible to him. Because what has Mark been for the last few episodes, but just a really unpleasant, you know, very cutting type of person. And then it completely flips on us. And it's actually, oh my God, the buddies are back together.
Yeah, I love it, because he's, because Doug says to him, your mouth is open. And then Green says, you know, oh, did you take a, does she make you take a lie detector test every week? And then they have this really fun scene where they're kind of spilling beer at each other and running around. And it's very cute. It's very, it's vintage Doug and Mark, the relationship we know they have, which is really
bringing each other beer and pouring beer on each other, and it's
again metaphors.
Oh my God.
And then Mark's setting up the film projector, because we know the dad left behind some home films, which I think is very brave of them to look at, but that's what they're going to do. And Doug's looking at pictures of his dad, and he finds in this box, he finds a letter that Sherry wrote before she passed. Obviously hasn't set it out, it's got a address on it of a place nearby, and she's got, and then he finds lots of pictures of his dad with what he thinks is Sherry and a baby, and he starts wondering if this baby is related, because that's how his dad is, you know, man of millions of children possibly, and wouldn't always tell the people.
And what else as well, but I mean, it's not really explored in this episode, but this woman is his mother-in-law.
Stepmom.
Yes, this woman is his stepmom. So not
who did Doug marry?
Well,
I went along with you. That I was like, yeah, that's what. Hang on.
Yeah, it's like, right, okay, cool. Anyway, this one. So he never got to meet her. He never got to know her. And in a way, there's no real connection other than his dad. But here's a whole other side of a family that Doug now has the option, if he wants to get to know.
Possibly, yes. Yeah. And yeah. And this starts an interesting conversation with Green, because Green talks about his relationship with his dad and how when he calls home, you know, his dad always passes him straight over to his mom, and it's quite a strained relationship. So we get that little hint at this point. So it's another father and son in this episode. And then they get the projector working, and it's baby footage of him when he was a kid, and his dad and his mom. And again, he's obviously very emotional.
Yeah.
But also, again, this is something his dad carried around, and it makes you wonder about, you know, was he still in love with the mom? And is this a big regret of his life that he couldn't make that work, you know?
Yeah.
And then Doug's really sweet because he tells Mark that he loves Carol, and he's so sweet about it. You know, I want to be with her, and when I'm not with her, I miss her. And it's that vulnerable and completely truthful talk between mates, isn't it? You know, he can be completely vulnerable and honest with Doug, and know that, Mark, and know that Mark's not going to take the piss or anything. He's just going to listen. And we get to see the real... Because we see Doug and Carol together, but he can't be this honest, I guess, with Carol in that way. So it's really sweet. I just loved it. I was like, oh my God, I love these two.
They are beautiful together. It's just, there's a bit later on. Sean, was your voice breaking a little bit there? You're like,
a little bit, a little bit.
I was just thinking, like, if this whole episode is making you think about the relationships in your life, especially with your parents, then you must have a heart of stone.
Yeah.
Or yes. you're like a clone or something, and you don't have parents. I don't know. But I know everybody has complex relationships, but it's got to make you think about your relationships, you know what I mean? Whether it's good, bad, or...
Do you know what it's funny about this episode is that it's both absolutely walloping you in the face with its message, but at the same time, at no point did I feel like it was walloping me in the face with this message.
Yeah. You know, you're exactly right.
You know, the writing sat down, did its job directing, but everyone in it, including extremely annoying Mark, just nails it in this episode. Nails it.
Well, it just presents it, doesn't it? It just goes, here's some complicated family stuff. It doesn't go, this is right, this is wrong. It just says, here... This is a human experience, and we watch it and we go, we recognize that. And that's, I think, what makes it so brilliant. I mean, Green starts telling Doug about the fact that, you know, his family moved around a lot and they lived in San Diego, and actually they still do. They moved around a lot because the dad was in the Navy. And so he says basically the family are still, you know, in San Diego. And Doug is straight away like, we need to go and visit then. We're here, we need to go and visit, and Mark is very against this idea, but Doug takes him, he makes him go, and they end up in quite a cute little looking suburban street. And
also I'll just say, they say, oh, it's only 4 hours drive,
as if like that's nothing, but to us it would be
cool. we're
down the road.
We'll be there by lunch. It's fine.
Exactly. Anyway, so they turn up at the house, and Mark is already saying to Doug, you know, don't drink the iced tea. She puts way too much sugar in. Mm-hmm. Tell her how much you love the Hummels, which are those little collectibles of the little people. And we meet Mark's parents. And I always love when we get to meet people. We get to meet the families or the friends, you know, the other people in their lives away from that, because you get to really paint pictures of the characters, don't you, further than just what we've been seeing in the hospital. The mom is so sweet, Ruth. She's so happy to see him. She welcomes him. She wants to give them iced tea. She's just so excited to see him. And you see quite a sweet relationship, I think, between her and Mark. You know, it seems very loving, and she's obviously very interested and asks about Rachel, and, you know, very invested. Doug keeps trying to leave because he obviously also senses, you know, they need to have time together. the Mark sees the oxygen tank and he's straight away is like, is dad still smoking? Is it emphysema? The mom, this is where the mom becomes a bit guarded. I think this is where we can imagine this kinds of conversations has been happening for a while. You know, the doctor son comes home and tells them they're doing everything wrong, possibly.
It's, you know, it's a mix between, and I mean, I'm sure in some ways, so many children do this to their parents that once we get to a certain stage of knowledge, experience, we start to, you know, go, oh, here's what I know, here's what I can, you know, bring to the table, if you like. Mark is an incredibly experienced doctor, so, you know, he starts to see medications and oxygen tanks. Well, sure, never mind the fact that I am a caring son. He's like, right, okay, well, I'm actually going to prescribe the following for you, and I'll do it like that because this is what I do every single day. And it has been my experience with my own parents and stories of other parents is that you could be the most experienced in X in the world. You are our child. You sit down and eat your dinner.
Exactly. And we get this really strange scene where Mark goes to actually speak to his dad, and his dad's doing some woodworking, and the whole way through is just smoking as well. And you can see how strained it is. You know, you can see Mark really trying and having to be the one to introduce the fact that Rachel's, you know, doing well and she's smarter than them, and or she thinks she's smarter is what he says, and the dad replies that's kids for you, which is again, you know, a real dig at Mark. It's a really painful moment because it's just so, you can really see it, the dad just doesn't know what to say, and Mark interprets that as he doesn't care for me is the sense, I guess, and he's trying to push him to care or guide him into how he should ask. And sadly, you know, you can't change people. That's just
And of course, you know, I mean, the phrase "you can't teach an old dog new tricks" comes into mind because Mark's dad is, you know, very much, you can see from this short depiction of him, oh, wow, is he set in his ways? He is ex-Navy. He's, you know, he's all these stereotypical things added together that if there's one person who is not going to seek help in any kind of... Like, I imagine there was a struggle to get him on an oxygen tank, let alone anything else.
Yeah.
You know? And I also imagine he's one of those people that when he was first diagnosed and they said to him, you know, take this medication and do this, he's never deviated from that, even though things have maybe moved on and there are other, you know, you still should be going back because there are advances and there are different ways, and we sometimes learn some medication isn't as great, but he's just, this is what the doctor told me, this is what I do, I'm not going to keep going back. And then you see the tension between Mark, the tension that brings up between Mark and his mom, because he starts lecturing the mom about the medications he's seen in the cabinet, and we've heard him kind of moan about the fact that she has too much sugar in the iced tea. Now he's moaning about the salt intake, and she's very much like, it's fine, my cholesterol's down, and he's saying, yeah, but it's not just about that, you know, it's not just about your heart, or, you know, your blood pressure and your heart rate and all that stuff. It's kind of a combination. She just doesn't want to hear it, and she also doesn't want to hear it about the dad. She becomes very defensive, I think, when he goes after the dad, but kind of mentions things about the dad. And I imagine the mom's probably always felt a bit stuck in the middle between Mark and the dad all the way through them growing up, and feels like she can understand where they go wrong, but they don't seem to be able to understand that about each other. And she knows that there's love there, but it just felt very much like a well-worn. She knew what was coming. She knew how it was going to be.
She knows the rhythm and the meter of their arguments. Do you know what I mean? It's a plate of, as you say, that they've gone through time and time again. And even in the bit in the garage, like, I think his dad is trying to tell him, oh, I was a dad too, I know what it's like, but it's just that butting head. They can't see that. Maybe his dad was actually saying, oh yeah, I know what you mean, kids, not in a, well, you were a little too, do you know what I mean? It's his dad was trying in his own way. It's so familiar with me and my dad, and loving to bits, and we can have great conversations, but at the same time it's quite frothy, and you know, it's great, but I think everybody's, a lot of people have a relationship with that, with a gruff father. Do you know what I mean? It's the garage dad.
And I think they're so, I mean, what really jumped out to me about it was just the generational thing as well. You know, this dad was so from a time of, you make the money. You do not sit at home and read stories to the kids, or, you know, you teach the kid to catch and you do manly stuff, but you don't sit and do the school. Yeah. What's this, you know? Yeah. And I think also being in the Navy, and that there's something about, there were, because that's huge part of the life of kind of Dr. Green's parents. You know, they live near the base, their life is the base. Yeah. Everything she does is about the base, even though he's not in the Navy anymore and he's out. And I think that's it, that's what it said to me. It said, you know, this is such a different generation. And I'm not saying our dads are any better or whatever or any worse, but there's a real sense, I think, I could really understand who these people were and why things were the way they were. And then they have dinner at what he says is so early. Like, I don't think Doug expected us to be having it mid-afternoon.
It's like 3 p.m. or something. Yeah.
But then Mark makes this really sweet suggestion where he says, let's go get ice cream after dinner. And I thought that was just so sweet and so wholesome. Like, it's such a thing that parents do with kids when they're little. Yeah. For him as an adult to be like, let's go do something that we may have done when I was a kid, and the mom is like, yeah, and the dad's like, nope, going to the club. And again, it feels like a rejection of Mark, but I think his dad is just so set in his ways, and those days I do this, and I don't understand this being flexible. Like, no, you know, this is what I do.
Yeah, routine in the armed services, especially the Navy, I guess. It's a lifesaver. It's, you make sure things are done in a certain way, because if something goes wrong, then, you know, I don't know, funny enough, not being in the Navy, the ship might sink, or do you know, any number of calamities could happen if those routines aren't upheld. And he's just, as you say, he's stuck in that. It's like when he's lighting the cigarette, he was still cupping his hand, and Mark had to be a bit of a smarty pants and say, there's no wind. You know, he just does it because he's used to do it on deck. And
This is what I do, you know, this is how I do this,
It's not ideal, but...
No. I also really thought the way that they choreographed the fact that all the way through, anytime he's in a scene, he's either smoking or coughing.
Yeah.
I just thought, gosh, that became such a background noise, you know, it's such a part of life. And you can see that Mark is... It's frustrating him because he can see the cause and effect, and he can't kind of take the fact that they are not listening to that. The mom says, actually, why don't you go to the club with your dad? And both Mark and her dad are vehemently, no, what club? I never heard of a club. Did I say there's a club? No, it burnt down. You know, it's really like anything to get out of it.
Oh my god, she's so good though. She's so clearly like, you are both stupid man folk. All right. Yeah. Someone needs to intervene here. And, you know, but she does it subtly enough.
You know.
But then she also has this resignation of, I'll say these words, I pretty much know what the answer is going to be, but someone has to say these words.
And I've got to try, you know. I think there's that hope of maybe one day, you know. The next time we see the dad, he's asleep with his oxygen tank on in front of the TV. Mark kind of goes outside to smoke, which I just thought this backstory was hilarious, because now it makes his smoking, which was already ridiculous, even worse. Yeah. You know, he's lecturing his dad, but then he's smoking, and his mom kind of sees him and says, you know, and he's like, no, I'm quitting tomorrow, don't worry. And then we hear about what he was like as a kid. You know, he used to flush her cigarettes down the toilet, or, you know, he just, anytime she came back with cigarettes, he would just get rid of them. And since then, she's stopped smoking and doesn't smoke. So it's even more of an underline of how absurd his smoking is when he was so against it for so long.
A little bit of a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little. I loved this moment though, this discussion between him and his mom about the dad. And he says, you know, my dad doesn't care about me. She's like, he does. You just don't get how he does it. It's just not the way you expect it. And I think moms do this a lot, like, you should try, because I think they're so used to the, the dad's being set in the ways, it's like, maybe it's up to you to try, maybe try something different. You should be the more understanding one. You're not as inflexible as him, which Green does not, you know, he said, well, why should it be all on me? And why do I have to make all the effort and be the understanding one? So they have a bit of a clash here, but I thought it's so interesting because I bet it's a bit similar with Doug, that when Mark isn't there, the dad probably is nice about him and maybe talks about him nicely.
Yeah.
And then Mark turns up and he just doesn't say it to his face. So the mom's like, honestly, he does love you, but if you could just access it a different way, or maybe not expect him to love you, and not think he doesn't love you because he doesn't love you the way you want him to, you know, accept that the way he loves you is different, but it doesn't mean it's any less.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, because so frustrating when you're like, you know, kind of just tell him you love him, will you? Just like, I couldn't possibly do that. Sure, didn't I make sure there was food in his table? You know, anybody?
Exactly. That's love.
I know he's not Irish, but many, many Irish fathers, I feel, are very, I think just fathers in general.
I was going to say, exactly, but I liked that. I could see Mark's dad being Irish in that moment. And then we get this scene where Mark has, like, obviously left the house and he's standing by some kind of bridge, and Doug comes to meet him, and Mark's very angry, and Doug says he'd basically driven over to that address, and it turns out the baby wasn't related to him, but he's now got another address so he could go and find out who this family are and tell them about Sherry, or maybe learn more about her. And this is where Mark, I don't know how Doug didn't throw him again off the bridge at this point, because Mark says, you know, you didn't miss much without your father being around.
So toned, Mark.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And they'd been having such a good episode. And, you know, we had that kind of the joke around Carol back with Mark. So they can have that bit of ribbing, you know, they could, you know, that's not the end of the world. But, oh, my God, this is Mark. As I put in the message group, as we were just, Doug's dad's body isn't cold yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's horrible, Mark. I'm sorry now. That's indefensible.
Yeah. Exactly. Especially because Doug has also very much realised how short life is and has obviously taken Mark to see his parents, because he's saying to him, life is short and tomorrow's not promised. I've lost my dad. And then he throws it back in his face and says that. And this is where Doug is just brilliant, because he says, oh, okay, so, you know, did your dad come and hit your mom and hit you and throw upon you and drive off and leave you? You know, basically lists all the hideous things. It's like when somebody's got a cough and somebody's, I don't know, got cancer, and the person with the cough says, oh, my life's so hard. And the person with cancer's like, hang on a minute. You know, I think it just really, he's just playing such a victim, Mark. Everything in his life is the worst. His self-pitying is hideous. And Doug just doesn't let him. He doesn't let him get away with that. He really just has a go and says, you know, the fact of the matter is your dad was there every night, food was on your table, he was home with you and your mom. That's love. That's his way of showing it. Yeah. That is what you had versus what I had, which was this inconsistent, violent, angry, alcoholic, womanizing man, you know.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was so necessary. He really needed to kind of say that. But he's kind of still not, when they're driving back, you know, Doug says to Mark as well, like, we should have stayed longer. We realize however they left the house was abruptly, because they'd originally said they were going to stay the night, and now they're back on the road, back going to Barstow, back to the motel. And and Doug's very like, this isn't right. We shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't have left it the way we did. And Mark apologizes and says, you know,
talk about fist in the air moment.
I know, and it's a breakthrough, absolute breakthrough.
I think, like, because the most that he and Doug have had crossed words really since the attack has been Doug just like, come on, it's getting harder to be your friend. Yeah. It's been really measured. It's been in the context of the ER, so he can't really lose the head at him. But of course, Doug, and is completely in the right, by the way, when he loses the head at Mark over what he says. I think Mark has been sitting in his own worry, self-pity and fear for so long and hasn't been openly challenged because everyone's trying to be so nice to him.
Yeah.
He hasn't.
Because he's really been attacked. Don't pile on to him. He's had this attack happen.
Victim, victim, victim. And then going back to Cynthia, who is lovely and, of course, needy, and all she wants to do is make her partner happy. Yeah. Of course, oh my God, Mark, you're so right in absolutely everything you say. Oh, exactly. You are right to be a delicate petal, you know? And it's just like, they are so wrong for each other at this time. But and Doug doesn't hold back. Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say, especially in that episode, the last episode where, you know, Mark was really nasty to that woman who he basically was like, oh, yes. It's just anxiety. And Carol says, well, of course she left. You know, you were shouting at her. And Cynthia goes, oh, I don't believe that. And it's like, oh, he really, you're not the person around him. He needs somebody to be Carol and be like, this is not on, you know. But he, you know, Mark apologizes, says he's been very self-pitying and which isn't his best quality, and he's been acting like a victim, and he's gotten so insular that he's forgot that other people are having stuff go on too, you know. And it was my moment to take a vitamin D, you know, like, obviously, yes, finally you've understood, you know, you're just.
It's funny when Mark was describing how he felt all those years. He was describing classic anxiety to me. He was saying, I was holding my breath, waiting for something bad to happen. I was like, that's it. And then something bad did happen and it compounded. Do you know what I mean? It was so interesting that he was exactly what he's been living with. Like, he's like a high functioning anxiety, anxious person almost.
All his life, and I don't know if it's maybe because their family moved around a lot, because he's very much like, I need to control the chaos. That's why I became a doctor. And we have that moment with the mom as well, where he's questioning her about the fact that they live near the base when the dad's not even part of the base anymore. And we learn also that, you know, the dad was actually treated quite badly by the Navy because he tried all the time to be promoted and they never promoted him, but he still lived his life for that, and they still lived their life for this base. And he's very much, and she says to him, you know, we like this life, we know you never did. So we get this idea that he was always rebelling or very angry at his parents for the life they had given him. And so he talks about he wanted to control this chaos, he just wanted to always be one step ahead. And then this is what broke my heart for Mark, when he says about the fact that the person he was died in the bathroom that day and he just doesn't know what's left. And I just thought, that is it. Yeah.
Just heart. But the fact that he said it, and it's such an over the top yet completely understandable statement, is, you know, is this it, Mark? Are you starting to see that, you know, you don't have to have died in the bathroom at that time? And admitting that means you have been walking around as the walking dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, really, it's such a big moment. It's such a big moment for Mark.
Yeah. And hopefully the moment of healing, because we've had moments before where he's realized he's gone a bit far or this hasn't worked, but this felt so much more like real ownership of the fact that he's as much to blame for some of the stuff that's going on, then it's not just all that, you know, somebody beat him up. It's like, actually, what has been my reaction and what has led me to this point? And that's where you heal from it, don't you? And well, this, you know, Doug also says to him, he's not coming back with him. He hands him a letter, says, you know, CHE, you go give this to Carol Hathaway. I'm not coming back. I'm going to go trace this family. They get back to the motel. And they're going to open the doors and Doug turns his head.
I tell you, like, every now and again, and this almost sounds ridiculous. It isn't. We're literally doing a podcast about ER. But it almost sounds ridiculous that you can get so into the moment that it affects you so much. But when Doug just goes quiet and Mark's like, hey, Doug, what's going on, buddy? What's up, Doug? What's going on? And then that music starts. Because there, that little piano tune, and who's standing there, and totally, like, and this is where, funny enough, this is where there not being a remaster of ER has actually paid off, because she's just out of focus, but you know that Carol has come down all the way down here to see Doug, and I literally just the biggest smile on my face.
Yeah, it's just beautiful, you know, because it shows how in sync they are. You know, he was saying to her, "I wish you were here. I need you." She instinctively knew that and was on a plane and got there.
So here I come.
Such a good payoff. You know, he runs to, they hug, and you just, I felt a bit of a breath of, like, I didn't realize I was holding my breath as much as I was, but I think I was for Doug, because he's just got so much going on. And then she comes, and all of a sudden it felt like, oh, okay, I've got safety. I've got some kind of safe space and person who's here just for me, not Mark with his issues, you know. I've got my Carol, who makes me feel like I'm at home. And it's just, it's perfect as well, because they had the whole episode where they, you know, Mark and Doug have been dealing with their things, and then Carol just comes in at the end to add this real breath of fresh air. And also just, it felt like a new chapter, you know, the next shot when they're actually going up the hills again, it felt like a lot of that baggage had gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they kind of, I mean, Mark is still moaning, oh God, I couldn't walk up another hill. Again, perfect moment to push him off. I don't know why Doug didn't do it.
There's not a jury would convict you at this point.
He'd be picked clean by the vultures again. So
I think even they'd reject him at this point. Sorry.
I think so too. I think they'd be like, this is too gamey. Like, this person is bitter as, you know.
We can eat anything, but this is just toxic for us. So
exactly.
Healthier, thank you. Organic human or something.
Exactly. And it's really beautiful, actually, because he's got the canister, he's gonna pour out his ashes of his dad up this mountain, and you know, it's a real moment of closure and goodbye, and they say, should we say a prayer? And what I love is, so he starts pouring out the ashes, and his goodbye to his dad, which I thought was just perfect, he says, I hated the son of a bitch and I loved him.
I know.
And I thought, that's exactly it in a nutshell, you know, that's what it is, that you can be treated so hideously by somebody, but also have these moments of greatness. And that's what happens. You hate that person, but you love them.
Like, that's what you, if we chose who we loved, what an easier, albeit boring, world this would be.
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then it's just beautiful, because they all kind of raise up a toast to him, and you know, they're all standing in formation, and it's around these beautiful rocks, and they have their drink, and then the camera kind of pans away down into the car, and we're looking through the windshield of the car up at the people.
Nip downstairs real quick, sorry. So carry on.
And they're all standing kind of on that hill in formation, and they're all cheersing obviously to the memory, and then they take this drink. And then the camera kind of pans down, and we see the three of them at the top of the hill through the car windscreen. So the dad is still there, you know, and it's just beautiful. It's just, as you say, cinematic, and it's the perfect ending to this story. You know, it's not about anything else but saying goodbye at this point.
100%. That shot, I wrote that down because it's just, and it's so, it's funny to say this, it's so not ER. And I love when ER takes these kind of risks, if you like. It could be, this could have edged into melodrama. I don't think it does, but this could have edged into melodrama. And they found the balance just right. And you said it perfectly, that perfect closing shot, the dad is still with them. They are framed in the windshield, and
because aren't we all the products of our parents, and they are the frame in which we live our life?
Oh my God, Sharon.
Ooh.
I don't think I've ever been so attracted to you. That was amazing.
Thank you.
I also love that it's the friendship of the three.
Yeah.
And you get these bits that it's Carol and Doug who have been calling Mark out the whole time.
Yeah.
And their friendship is solidified in this second. Do you know what I mean? And it is just it's a beautiful moment. This whole episode, I'll say it 15,000 times, it is a beautiful.
It's a proper chef's kiss, isn't it?
Perfect.
It's just great. And it's exactly what we needed, you know. We needed, we've had Mark be in the hospital, claustrophobic, stressed, and we get him out and we air him out a bit and we explore other sides of him and we get some possible understanding, but we also get growth from him. And what I really love is that at no point did they have Doug like breaking down, smashing everything, crying, you know, in that really melodramatic, my dad's dead, I'm going to smash everything.
Yeah.
It just felt a bit more real, a bit more like shock and moments of this and moments of that, rather than I'm just going to break down, you know, which I thought was really powerful about the whole thing. And again, you know, it's ridiculous they didn't get nominated or awarded anything for this episode.
Oh, but
they should have.
They should have,
This is just brilliant. And there was a little bit of trivia, and I don't think it was meant in this way, just because I don't think they knew at the time. But at the end of the episode, they say the camera angle foreshadows the order that the characters exit the show. First Doug, then Carol, then Mark. But at this point, I don't think they knew when Carol and Mark were going to leave. So I don't think it was purposeful. But it's just a little bit of kind of interesting bit in there. Should we do our Ibers?
Yes. I have Bonnie Bartlett, who plays Mark's mom.
Yeah.
And so funny enough, she was in ER before, but as a patient in season one.
Yes, so she was,
She's been bumped up slightly. I would have known her for playing Linnea in Stargate SG-1.
Linnea.
So she would have been Linnea, the destroyer of worlds. yes, she was, you know, all right then. They get kind of chucked into prison, and then this lady, everyone's always afraid of her. They help her escape, and then they realize, whoops, we were not meant to help her escape. It's very early SG-1.
Right. It's been a long time, and it's due a rewatch, but...
Blank. She played Dean Boland in Boy Meets World. And what's brilliant about this is that she married Mr. Feeney in the show, and in real life, she is actually married to William Daniels. So she's one of those who's been around a lot. She was in Parks and Rec, Home Improvement, Grey's Anatomy, Salem's Lot. She's just one of those great actresses who's been around. But I most recognised her from her stint as Dean Boland.
Who was she? Sorry, I'm going to keep doing this. Who was she in Parks and Rec?
I have no idea. You'll have to.
that's fine. You got to be good.
And then we had John Cullum, who played Captain David Green. And a fun fact about him is that in this episode, he's chain smoking Lucky Strikes. And years later, he's on Mad Men playing the CEO of Lucky Strike, Lee Garner Sr., which I thought, again, it's one of those things that has just obviously just happened out of nowhere, but it's one of those beautiful, poetic moments of life, I feel like. Sorry, Karen.
No, sorry. He was in Northern Exposure, which is his other big role in the 90s, from 1990 to 1995, as Holling Vinker. I guess that's how you pronounce his name. So I think that must mean, anyway. I remember him from that, and I remember him being in ER as well, and just having that kind of, people could be two things, when I was a younger person. He's also in Quantum Leap. He's been in 30 Rock, Roswell, all sorts. I mean, just crazy amounts of Mad Men, as you said. Law and Order Special Victims Unit with Mariska Hargitay.
Mariska Hargitay.
Yeah. He's just got a wonfully gravelly voice. I think he's brilliant. Kimmy Schmidt as well.
Yeah, and The Good Wife with Juliana Margulies.
I was going to say he was in The Good Wife.
I missed that one. Brilliant actor.
There was another thing I just wanted to point out, which I thought was really... Well, it's just very different for this episode. I don't know if you noticed, but the title card, the way it's dead, normally it fades away. And this one, it travelled.
Oh, did it?
That really sideways, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because maybe they were travelling. I don't know. But yeah, that's another cute little trivia point.
Which
was fun.
Definitely.
Excellent.
I think then the nature of the episode is we don't really have an awful lot else of other guest stars to kind of go through.
No.
No, I just wanted to cover lastly, just talking about what his dad had, which was emphysema. It's a lower respiratory tract disease, and it's basically caused by tobacco smoking and air pollution. So it is one of the major side effects of smoking. if it's apart from lung cancer and COPD. But it's caused by the breakdown of the lung and the alveoli. So it reduces the surface area in which gas exchange can occur. So that's why he's on oxygen. That's why he's coughing to catch his breath, because there's just, it's his body saying, we need more oxygen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's, yeah. So a friend of the show, Dr. Martin, has said in a healthy lung, the surface area over which gas exchange can occur is roughly the size of a tennis court if all unfolded and laid out flat. So it's one of those facts you learn when you're a kid about like the blood vessels going around the earth twice and all this sort of stuff. But yeah,
actually, that's a good point, because did you know that if you take all of the blood vessels from a human body and lay them out flat, you will die?
You will kill that
no
person.
No way.
That person will not survive that encounter. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay, there you go. Another life hack from us there.
Boom.
Yeah.
Right, then I think we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget, you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.